I'm Gray Watson. I'm with Carolee Schneemann in the Great Eastern Hotel, London. Carolee is here in London as part of a week-long event at the Whitechapel Art Gallery called A Short History of Performance. And on Tuesday, that's a few days ago, she reenacted the classic work Meet Joy, originally performed in 1964. One obvious big difference between the recent reenactment of Meet Joy and the original is that it was 30-something years later, and obviously you've grown older in the process. One person I spoke to in the audience at the time said how wonderful it would have been if you had taken part, which you didn't. I mean, and another possibility would have been other participants also being more like your age. In other words, it would have acknowledged the aging process of the body. What, in fact, you did do was to use younger people, more or less the age that you and the original participants were.
The participants that I worked with were volunteers that came through some network that Whitechapel was able to establish. And I was rather stricken when I saw them, as not only were they younger than I wanted, but they were more wispy. They didn't have the presence of the untrained people that I used to find for my performance works. So I was definitely constrained by what I called my objet trouvé, and wasn't sure that the intensive training would even get us close to the energy of the piece. But it did. I couldn't have gone in it without a real partner to me. I would have looked, you know, like the old dame still strutting around with the younger group. That didn't feel right.
Had you had an older group, then might it have felt more all right?
Yes, that might have been fine.
Yeah.
When the body is really an aged body, then I'm not dealing with the recreation of Meet Joy 1964, when I inhabited like a 27-year-old body. It was kind of like a medieval being pulled apart by two horses, the one in the past and the one of my present that's also my future. So going back was quite daunting. I didn't want to do this recreation initially. I have an enormous amount of new work, you know, the video installation, shooting, editing, computer generating images. That's the work that I need to be doing and teaching to support it. This was another instance where I was afraid the past was going to kind of derail the present. It's just that the culture doesn't address the current work with the kind of concern that tends to be retroactive with what I do, but that's been consistent. The other thing is that I have a strong objection to the imposition of cultural principles. Like, why isn't a piece from 1960 about lesbian sexuality? So you get this retroactive punishing.
You mean people ask that question?
It's completely inappropriate, because they're not looking at what they're seeing. They're saying, we want this to do something different because this is what we care about now.
Apropos of that, I did notice that when the people started in the reenactment of Meet Joy, couples began to form and tentatively to approach each other and undress each other. One of the couples was male gay. And I presume that wasn't the case in the original, was it?
No, it wasn't.
So that was a piece of updating to the present, as it were.
Well, it was also serendipitous, because it turned out we had two more men than we had women. And I said, perfect, and we can switch the partnerings.
I never saw the original. You know, I had my ideas about it. And then when I first saw a film of it, I was a little bit troubled by Mark's of the particular moment, in particular the underwear,
eye makeup.
The eye makeup, which had a real look of the 1960s about it.
Yeah.
What I'd imagined as something a bit timeless suddenly got terribly rooted in the early 60s, if you see what I mean. And this made it slightly comic in a way which presumably wasn't intended.
Well, no, there was an irony to it, and the bikinis for the men and the women, they're funny. They're covered with all kinds of feathers that get all wrinkled and mushed with the fish and the paint. And tiny hunks of fur are tacked onto the men's bikinis.
So that was intended comedy, as it were?
No, it's Hot not one. Overt comedy. It was droll.
Right.
Yeah.
The way the underwear worked this time was just that, again, it seemed updated. But again, it presumably will, if people look back on the film or video of this event, seem rooted in 2002, as it were. It'll get a date mark, whereas obviously if people were naked, it would seem less dateable, I presume.
People were naked in the 60s. They're not running around naked now. We don't have streakers. We don't have living theater strippers. We might have solo women doing naked actions, but that is already referential to assertive, revelatory use of the nude by women in the 70s, when it was aggressive and revelatory.
One other thing before we move on from Meat Joy really concerns the meat. When you throw in the chickens and the fish.
And the sausages.
And the sausages. And people were tossing them around. And even more so when one person either took it upon himself or you directly identified to chop up a chicken and hurl bits into the audience, which everyone tended to think was good fun. I thought, well, this couldn't be done with human corpses. If bits of human corpse are flying into the audience, people would be horrified beyond belief. It did make me think about our relationship with other species, just how very, very unequal it is. Certainly, no, I'm not saying it's in any way worse than eating them. Do you see what I mean?
Well,
but it does show a certain, you know what I mean, the difference.
Using them as the materiality of human flesh, because we're not cannibals, even in our most extreme wishes to devour one another, that becomes metaphorical. The meat, for me, comes out of being a chicken farmer, where I had to, in an old-fashioned way, chop the heads off, you know, hold the wings back, sharpen my little axe, and slaughter usually 17 or 18 chickens every Friday.
Gosh.
And steam them and pluck them. So the chicken has always been very close to my sense of a manifold property as an expressive form, as a food source. Because of its scale, it resembles both the child and the bird that it is, and the feet are extremely expressive, like roots, upside down chicken feet. The meat itself, just the idea of meat, that's kind of amorphous, whereas the fish are exquisite and carry an intensive religious, sacral, and practical metaphor. And the sausages, of course, are the most permitted phallic form that we all grow up.
And scatological.
Yes, and scatological. But but they're pleasured. All these associative elements are pleasured in my work. They're not about an ordeal or violence. It's an extension of flesh. It's a sense of eroticizing the body through these materials. And those materials include the plastic and the paint.
You did say in the discussion after the reenactment of Meat Joy that you weren't in the least bit interested in performance. You were a painter. In the recently published book, Imaging Her Erotics, which has pictures and texts by you and about you, the first essay is by Christine Stiles, and she stresses very much your connection with a history of painting.
Which is a difficult argument, since almost no one except Christine acknowledges this contribution, so it's kind of a mysterious
contribution. But you agree with it, don't you?
Everything I do comes out of painting.
Comes out of doesn't necessarily mean is primarily about now, though.
Well, what I keep saying is, I'm quoting, painting doesn't mean that you have to put a brush to a canvas. It might mean that you activate your own body in a realm of materialities.
You obviously want to keep this connection with painting.
Yeah,
you obviously want to stress that.
Drawing 8 hours a day, studying the traditions of visuality, means that my perceptual skills and the rigor of my skills are aesthetic as well as functional.
What does functional mean in this context?
Well, functional is how you get through a revolving door. Right. And to protect ourselves, to know the room stops here and the window has glass on it. But
if we jump through it, we'd kill ourselves.
But as a painter, your perceptual lens is constantly going through it, jumping through it. But, you know, what I'm thinking about today is how all of the participants so far identify themselves as painters.
The participants in what?
In this performance festival.
Right, right.
The Kipper kids, painters. The Bernstein group, and I asked the most dour, severe one, what are you doing now? And he said, watercolors. Brizley is doing watercolors right now, coincidentally. Nietzsche is always painting with
He's always made the connection with painting, very explicit.
He always produces a painting. So that's interesting. We're all coming out of abstract expressionism.
Yes, well, I was looking at that soutine flayed ox in the Paris Capital of the Arts exhibition that Sarah Wilson curated, and making a connection, obviously, back to Rembrandt, but also forward to abstract expressionism. I thought, and then there's a straight line to Nietzsche.
Yeah.
And it's all very connected.
Yeah. Yes, it's very connected. That's been delicious. I'm so enjoying that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something that interested me, too, was the connection between your work and poetry.
Well, this little country schoolhouse from sixth grade to ninth grade, this is where poetry really absorbed me, because we had a remarkable teacher, Rose, the teacher, read us poetry. Tennyson, Wordsworth, Browning, Barrett Browning. She read poetry in the morning instead of a religious text, and then we sat in a circle and each of us had to read something that we had written. Well, that was where poetry first entered as a way of thinking and experiencing and translating both the concrete and the ineffable. The realm of language. It was a survival mechanism for me, too. So I immersed myself in whatever was difficult and not really comprehensible, because I knew that in order to save myself from this dreadful little village, that I would have to go as far into whatever poetry was as I could go.
So you felt this was a lifeline to something more extraordinary and wonderful and that you could grow with, in a way.
Right. And the first people who understood my work in a supportive way were poets.
Well,
in New
that's
York.
What I thought. Yeah,
yeah. I've written about that, and breaking the functional narrative of this is how, and you must, and this is what it means, and to take language itself as form and substance and a dynamic of time itself, time and space, how each sentence and word positions itself together and apart.
Obviously you felt quite early on, despite your interest in poetry and so forth, that your primary focus was going to be visual rather than verbal or musical, say.
Images.
You're interested in myth, and you're obviously interested in some post-Jungian ideas as well as psychoanalytical ideas. But it seems to me that some of what you do actually goes into a realm which one might almost say was the magical. The way in which you feel that you've been contacted by the spirit of your dead cat, Clooney, the way in which you feel finding dead creatures, particular creatures, can be associated with, there was a deer and there was a, what was the other?
Dove.
Yeah. Now, this seems to me almost that you're entering into a realm where things are significant in an almost magical sense. In a way which somewhat does defy what you might call Western scientific model of reality.
So, in fact, it's
a direct philosophical challenge.
And a political challenge.
Yeah. Explain what you mean by that.
I can't, but it's a contrary ethics.
I mean, I can see that it could be in opposition to to governments as they stand now, but also to most revolutionary thinkers.
And social structures as they exist.
And social structures
as they exist. It's an anarchistic realm in proportion to how we're conditioned to share certain beliefs and behavioral patterns and to recognize and esteem those values.
But we also come into complete conflict with any Marxist-based revolutionary thinking. And indeed, most existing revolutionary ways of thinking, wouldn't it?
I've been haunted by a statement that I've been trying to research it, and I finally found the source. It seems that I have a whole set of distorted philosophical statements, one of which that I searched for is the proper outcome of any revolution is the contentment of our cats. It's a distortion of Gandhi saying something like the true estimation of a culture's political health is the treatment of their animals.
Now that makes good sense, doesn't it?
Yeah. See, one of the odd things with the recreation of meat joy is so much of the underlying aspect of the exercises I teach come from the behavior of cats. At one point, they were practicing an exercise, not quite grabs and falls, but another where they have to leap on each other, and they didn't know how to do it. And I said, you do it the way it is when two cats have been facing each other and facing each other, and suddenly they move so fast you don't know if it's two cats anymore.
Yes, you talk to the participants in the reenactment of Meat Joy, but you
and the original ones I taught.
And all the original too.
Yeah. That's how I started to perform.
Right early on. Right at the beginning of the 60s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I formed all these
exercises.
You've always
had a thing about cats.
Yes, but these exercises don't all come from cats, but all the work, the spontaneity and the risk all develops from the exercises.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes there's an underlying energy in the exercises that I've learned from cats.
Right.
So this is the 7th of February 1999, 10:30 a.m. Sleeping here is not like sleeping anywhere else. I just woke up. There's a lot of snow outside. Last night I heard the girls howling, Vartamal, Vartamal, over and over into the morning. And sometimes I hear dogs barking. Vanya complains that she often is woken by the rooster in the backyard around 7 a.m. That means that she slept only 2 hours. A girl finding herself alone in a remote extended red light district in the Czech Mountains.
I'm here with Anne-Sophia Sedun at the Haywards Gallery during her exhibition, Hey Wait. I'd like to start by talking about the ideas behind this exhibition. It's an unusual exhibition in terms that it's both political and intimate. I'd just like to first of all talk about the way that you've living in the hotel, putting up relationships with many of the different people that you really met around this whole world.
I was actually invited to do something in the red light district in an art context, a group show. They were offering me contacts to pimps, prostitutes, whatever I wanted. And I went there for a short research trip. But as I was there, I was remembering an image of girls standing along forested roads in Eastern Europe just after the wall came down. Somehow, I sort of lost the whole change after the wall because I lived in America in all of the 90s. And I told them in Amsterdam that I'd rather go to the Czech Republic. Indeed, I did, yeah. I had contacts to a female organization helping prostitutes getting out of a bad situation they didn't want to be in. And the organization is targeting East European women who has been trafficked into the West or on the border. And the first interview I got through them, and that was with Kveta, a woman who had been working in Strasbourg against her will, and she finally escaped. And my story is a horrifying story. And after that, I felt like I almost could not go on with this, and I wondered what I was doing there. I'm not a journalist, I'm an artist. And I thought, like, what can you do? Either you become a social worker or religious because of the power of her words. However, I had a few days more in the Czech Republic, and I continued. I had a translator with me all the time. We ended up in Dubai in late evening in February. It was snow, it was cold, and we needed a place to stay. We had been warned, don't play with these people up there. It's not a place to just hang out on. By stroke of luck, or I don't know, the people in Motel Hubert were very friendly to me and also helped me to arrange some of the interviews with the girls working there or in other bars or along the road.
They're very emotional stories often, are very intimate. Can we talk about your feelings of doing this work?
Well, my feelings were, it was different sort of complications or paradoxes that I had to live through. I had to sit through and watch the girls being pushed out on the street, you know, to work. Yeah, that's the sound of the Greenpeace. Yeah, sometimes I found that very difficult, you know. Of course, you want to go out to this, why don't you let her go or let her earn her money herself or so. It's a very delicate dependency. It's also very brutal. There is no money. Many of the pimps were Romanis or gypsies, and they are on the very, very lowest scale, even then, in the Czech society. And, you know, the Second World War ended in 45, but here, maybe, in a way, it extended through the occupation, if you want to call it that, of the communist regime in Czechoslovakia and other countries. All of a sudden, they are standing there, now we are free, but to what? And I also think the title, Vartamal, reflects that. It came to mean something else for me when I was woken up by this cry of the girls trying to stop cars screaming.
You said it all night.
Yeah. Hey, wait, stop. What happened after the wall came down? And what happened to these people who were brought into this industry? For example, Milusa, who was working in a mine, and she traveled a lot. She traveled to Moscow, to Cuba, and conferences and so on. But of course, when the wall came down in 89, she was the first one to go. She walked out on the street after following an example of one of her friends. She had 5 children to feed and she couldn't get a job. I mean, people do what they can, you know, when it's about money and surviving. And also, of course, pornography had been repressed in the communist states and prostitution existed. We all know that, you know, you could get it through a taxi driver in small border hotel. But the explosion of this trade after the war is unbelievable. It's just unfathomable numbers of girls, up into the 800,000, I think.
Can we talk about the men you also interviewed, the different types of men you interviewed as well?
Well, I interviewed Klaus, who was just a regular client. I asked him actually at some point, is it hard to find women in East Germany? Yeah, but he says, well, you know, it's much easier in the Czech Republic, and who wants to go to disco in Germany anyway? I called it the Wild East because that's what I felt. I felt it was a frontier. I don't know. It's very hard to understand sexuality, but I think it comes to a very graphic situation when you are in the world of prostitution and when it's made into business, of course. The encounters I had with the girls, especially the girls who were working, who would, you know, do an interview with me for 1 or 2 hours and then the next hour they had to go down and work. Those moments were extremely strong for me when they revealed how they got where they were. And I think that the exhibition is composed by these more general views of the road, the girls standing winter, summer, day, night along the road. Opposite that, you have my private diary scrolling, as well as snapshots that I took, that the girls took, which is a view of Dubai or the place which I couldn't film. I think if there is voyeurism, it is in my diary, because it was also mind-boggling just to see the scenes that were taking place between girls, the clients, whether they want to go up, the expressions in their faces and so on. And the diary accounts for that. And then you have all the different angles. You have the motel owner, you have the girls, you have the motel owner's wife, who's sort of a bordel mama, but also friends of the girls. And you have the police story and how he explains what he can do, what he cannot do. Or he explains how his boss maybe has very long fingers, or a pimp has very long fingers, reaching all the way into the system of law. Between all of these things, often they talk about the same persons also, especially in the main room, in the Dubai room, and
you sort of get a pretty good grip of how the place works, I think.
Is video a medium you feel most comfortable with? And you've worked with video installation. Can we talk a little bit about the actual medium you're using here?
You know, video is something that people are extraordinarily used to it because they are used from watching TV for the last 40 years. We're born into a moving image culture, so it works very well. But one should also not forget that this place, Dubi, or the Czech Republic, is constantly changing, and each time I go back, there's some person who's not there. So you could say, even though I have these people on video, talking to them and showing them, they are still frozen moments. Video is it's an incredible medium.
I do think people's attention span is different for different works. And here, there is a variety of ways you can approach the medium. Large screens, smaller, more intimate spaces.
Text.
So that,
music.
In a way, it gives it a resonance as well, and the way that the stories all kind of interconnect.
Yeah, and I really try to build it up as sort of a journey, where the main peak on that journey might be the Dubi Room, where you are completely involved by sound, by reflections of images in plexiglass, the different voices where they go in and listen to one individual voice. Often you get caught up once you sit down. The viewers are also sort of part of the work in terms that you see to whom you want to listen to and so on.
Yes, I found that quite extraordinary, seeing that people were making decisions. They were always looking in, and the audience is drawn in to this culture almost, in a sense of the way that we're all looking and thinking, oh, I'll go and look at that one, that looks interesting.
Yeah, it was like recreating a village in a way, you could say.
Do you show the girls and the men your pieces, and how do they respond to them?
Some of the girls have seen, for example, Kveta saw the interview with her. That was a very touching moment. She cried. Her interview goes really from her living at home and having a stepfather who tried to rape her and so on, which is a classical story, I think, for many of these girls. Again and again, she's abused and she's misused, and it's really horrifying. But through those things, which were with clients or her profession, she didn't move an eyelid or a muscle in her face. Also asked some of the other girls, like Eva and Petra, if they wanted to see their interviews, and they said, no, Sophie, just bring the party tape. So I gave them that, and they were really happy, and they were showing it to the pimp, and he was saying, oh, you girls are so crazy when I'm not around.
There's quite a lot of examples of video art in the 60s and 70s dealing with issues of, you know, pointing the camera at someone, getting them to talk to camera about their story. You've done it very differently, but are you interested in that aesthetic from the past? I mean, who were your influences?
I was very touched by the Nan Goldin, especially her slide projection room, where she's also using music. I think generally documentary photography is fantastic to look at, but however, it doesn't speak, you know. If there's not a diary written along with those photographs, you cannot hear those persons, so it becomes a quiet sign on the wall. And I think that's the advantage of video, really, and this is the time and age that we're living in, so it's natural. 10th of February 1999. Once I got really drunk and insulted Katya's husband, Honza. I called him a pedophile, a greedy, horny old man who tries to save money by turning down the heat in the motel. He got really mad at me. He told me to leave. The next morning, I was packing my bags when Honza came in and asked what I was doing. I told him, I'm leaving. He said, no, don't leave. And he left my room. If I left, Katya would have no one to talk to.
I'm in the ICA in London with L.A. Raven. That's Elizabeth Raven and Angelique Raven, who are twins and who are working together as artists. I understand that at the age of 12, you became aware that there was something quite irritating about being treated as twins and as almost the same, and deliberately started going different ways. And there was a sort of pact, is that right, that one of you would do something artistic and the other would do something quite else?
Mm-hmm. We always had this problem that we have the same taste. but we wanted to be different. We didn't like to be a twin. Even when we are really small, 6 years old, we even did not like it. And
we want to be an identity, an individual who is alone, and a unique person, in fact. Being a twin, you are in fact not respected like that. You are not respected as an individual. You grow up with this feeling of always this attention of the twin thing. But, you know, you are a child of 6 years old, doesn't really realize what's happening. But at the age of 12, we really knew, okay, now we have to change schools. For example, we had the same taste because we were also brought up like the same and with the same identity. You look alike, and to be different, we realized that the circumstances could change you if we would go a totally other direction or make really concrete changement in ourselves. We would create ourselves different. But what do you do if you have the same taste or you want the same?
You had a sort of a gambling situation, did you, where you, in fact, Angelique, were lucky and got the artistic side? Well, you both wanted to be artistic, is that right?
Yeah, we both wanted that, but you have to consider that at the age of 12, so we flipped up the coin.
Mm-hmm. Literally.
Yeah, but we put something bad against it. For example, we had beautiful long black hair, mm-hmm. and I had to cut it.
That was your payment for being lucky.
Yeah, that was one kind of, but at the age of 12, which was this extremely important.
You are only a child. To make my pain of the second choice less painful, in fact.
Artistic meant, first of all, that you went to an art school.
Mm-hmm.
Did fashion seem an artistic choice from the start, or did you drift into fashion later?
Well, I was always kind of obsessed with how people looked like, why people were popular also. Maybe it's also something from your childhood that when we were together in the school, more people found me more popular. I think that has something to do with it, but I was always obsessed with how people looked like and why they were so successful, and I was really a perfectionist in that. I was always drawing people.
Is
always.
That school before you went to
art? No, always as a child I was always drawing people, only people.
Mm-hmm.
But drawing meant like, oh, maybe you are, you know, sometimes you draw clothes with it because this person is wearing something. And then you came also more like interested in clothes, and because it has to do with it. I realized when I went to the art college, you know, with drawings, and then you have to choose a direction. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do? And I didn't know what to do. Mm-hmm. I just wanted, and because the drawing and the people were that important, you turned up to, you know, to do fashion.
And so you did that as your course?
Yeah, and also drawing. I kept up doing, I was, in fact, not really a designer, because I was just doing my thing.
Mm-hmm.
For example, like, I can't really make clothes. I didn't like to do it. I didn't like to make patterns or anything. You know, I was much more with my hands in that way. So I make kind of collection with clothes, what I did. Jean-Paul Gaultier, he saw my last show last year, and he immediately asked me to work for him as a...
So you went right to the heart of the fashion industry.
Yeah, immediately, you know, and then because it got really lots of attention in Antwerp. But at the same time, I saw Lisbeth a little bit suffering. I was, in fact, not really happy because I was extremely missing her all the time. And then we were sometimes calling, but we tried to have no contact.
If we would see each other just one time a week or so, made it the missing worse, you know.
I knew at the moment Lisbeth was really also not happy in the world. She was,
which was a nursing world, a medical world, a hospital world.
Yes, I was interested in not in nursing as a job, but more in medical things, because interested in genes and somehow like finding a proof that we were not a twin. Like, that's why I was interested in these genes, you know, how we maybe I could transform my genes.
Why we were
so it came directly from your twin situation.
Why maybe we were
a little bit different. Why? Finding the proof that somehow we were not a twin. Then when you're working in the hospital, you see a lot of interesting things which has to do with genes. And so I just blocked out the art interest.
So why were you unhappy?
Because I didn't really like it. I felt every time as my second choice.
When I was looking to Lisbeth, I saw her, she viewed it as an artist.
Well, I swapped so many schools. I went in Holland to a nursing school. I went in Belgium to two different nursing schools. So I did the study really long. Yeah, and then I saw so much suffering and said, Lisbeth, stop. You have to stop. Just go to do what you want, but don't choose passion.
This led to photography.
Is that right?
Before we get on to that, you said that your first work together was this work on an ideal person, and that had to do with a coming together in some way. Did I understand this rightly? Of your two now different backgrounds,
we have similar interest in people, although I look to people in a very different way than Angelique does.
Because of the work,
because
of the medical thing, do you think? Did you also draw people a lot
as
a child?
No, when we were small, we both drew the same, similar. Because I really went first into nursing and...
Could you tell me how you got to meet Orlan?
After my graduation, I was really thinking what I'm going to do and what do I think is interesting in art. And, you know, you grow up in Holland on an art school, and when you look in art history, then I always thought these older artists, you know, in history, their life and their work is much more present in their work than artists nowadays. And it was also that then I was just finding out which artist nowadays is really involved, you know, in this similar kind of really paying for his artwork.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, and
because
that's why
your obsession
was really interested in Orlan, because I said, oh, she's really giving her body to art. Mm-hmm. That's something which you know what you can do.
And so then you got to meet her.
Well, I was not, after working 5 years in fashion, it was not satisfying anymore for me, because at the end, it's all only about selling. It's not about new ideas. It's no art, the fashion world. It's consumerism. Orlan doesn't speak really good English, so she really need an assistant.
Mm-hmm.
And also because she was interested in me, because she knew Angelique was working for Jean-Paul Gaultier, and she also works with fashion designers in her artworks. And the funny thing was, in my last connection of Antwerp, I did something with plastic surgery also.
Your first work, actually working together, calling yourselves now L.A. Raven, which of course at first suggests you're one person, was this work with the body ideal. And you took your own very thin bodies as an ideal. How much do you see that as a parody of the fashion industry, or was it...
Well, it is also, if you look to, for example, fashion magazines, you also see very, very thin women. And also, for example, Jürgen Teller, he also makes pictures of really thin models who look also anorexic, but they still have a sexy touch. So then you don't see it as problematic. We really start to think men as an image and not sexy anymore.
And that you already did with your ideal type.
Yeah, to make it something.
And also,
as well as more reason.
And also when, you know, I was really so fed up with fashion and the fact that I was realizing that the brand is not about clothes, but more about presenting an atmosphere each season than actually the clothes. And I thought, this is in fact more important which models you choose and how they look like and what atmosphere they bring, and you could make a total new brand of that. And we thought maybe if we are going to, for our first project, cast all girls who look like that, all like me, we can make a kind of new brand, you know. That was our first...
So sort of playing around.
I was just coming from this really... It was really fresh, still the fashion influence.
But also the medical experience fed into this, didn't
it? Because we are always discussing all the time. Also that we were always discussing what's then a nice image for a woman. You know, we didn't like the Claudia Schiffer image with a woman-like, with big breasts and... for every audience there is a magazine. For each dog of Darwood Group there is a magazine, you know. Ideal for a lower, a different target group than, for example, elves.
Subtly different, but perceptibly different. Yeah. And you can map out ideals.
We saw also that people, for example, the target group with more money or more successful, they had a thinner image than, for example, a magazine for lower class.
But I consider contemporary art completely mixed up with the consumer and marketing world nowadays. I think this media world influence, you know, in the 60s has been such a huge influence on the art world makes it really, this connection is too close. But although it has always, it has really, everything has an influence. In fact, the purpose of an artist seems to be to comment on this society where we live in. Like, that's why you have to stay, in fact, as an artist, outside of that society to be able to comment on it.
Mm-hmm. Now, in Wild Zone, which is what's showing down here, you have two screens, one of which just shows one of you, and the other shows both of you. And if I remember rightly, one of you is wearing a vest with short sleeves and the other a singlet without any sleeves at all. And it's the singlet which is single on the screen, the one just alone. And then you have two other screens with boys and it's exactly the same clothing coding.
Yeah.
They're together with one short sleeves, one singlet, and the one in the singlet is shown also on his own. Why so similar?
Well,
why with the same clothing coding?
Because we wanted to reflect what we did also on them. And so also exactly the same.
It has to do with this looking for, we had to look for an ideal image like us, you know, and you had to fit the ideal image requirements. And when we put this ad also in newspapers in Holland and in Austria, and we got a lot of reactions of also boys. We were really looking for people who could fit into our clothes, actually.
Mm-hmm. I knew by drawing and all meters that it was a boy of, in fact, 14 years.
And so
they could have the same image.
It's not so obvious on screen that they are that young.
To make clear that they could fit into our clothes, they had, in fact, to wear exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
We have, like, the same taste, so we always tend to choose the same clothes.
You're wearing the same now, it must be said.
Right now we are wearing also black jumper and blue jeans, but slightly different. So it's also about this coat.
Because we have only one thing about
it. It also
everything.
Becomes like an army. It's a uniform, but it must be always something
different.
We don't
want to think about the clothes, but we don't want the clothes are in that way not that important. Just have to be something where it's more about the image of
and something without no brand.
Identity. And something without brand also.
We definitely realize that we are not ideal, but we want to make it ideal. Because then we have the same power as Claudia Schiffer, because she's now ideal in magazines, and
if you
and
are,
that's why the consumer world.
A person is more beautiful, or more ideal, or more seen as perfect, has more success.
And the whole world is going to adjust on this ideal image.
Now, your working together is very much to do with the fact you are actually twins. Have you any thoughts about other partnerships of people working together, like Gilbert and George? Or
there are a lot of artists working together as a team, in twos.
Yeah.
And we always think that was problematic, you know. Also, that's why we named ourselves LA Raven, like we are being one person.
You didn't want to be like these duos.
No, it's like that we saw that it's really problematic in it, because, you know...
Why problematic?
Well, you can't deny, you know, that you have been influenced also in this marketing world. It would be not fair to be honest about that. It's true.
But we didn't like that image. We didn't. In fact, you know, we didn't like the image of Jim Bob and George, what they had.
But it's too close to a comedy act or something, or what?
Felt like
it was much more nicer, you know, it's like also with this
this eagerness to be one individual, and also even to be a team with two artists was even not nice.
That was the irritation. I was really, when you work in fashion, you notice also that it was much more cooler or successful to be a man's name or something, or a man or an artist is more successful, or especially in fashion, it's much more cooler to be a man as a designer than a woman.
Really?
I think that's also for an artist way, I think also a little bit like that, and that's why also we took the name LA, I think. But they are all influences also from your background, from your childhood, why we took it, I think.
But does it have to do with Los Angeles, because that's the first thing you think of?
No, it's Elizabeth and Angeles.
I understand that is in fact so, but I wondered if you like the connotations of Los Angeles.
I like that it's so, if we would have different initials, we would have been different,
You didn't want to make up a new name, like Orlando or something.
No, you just want to do, because then it becomes like a statement. But also it becomes, after a few years, you want to change your name again, because you know that.
All the same, it does seem that you are exaggerating something that you don't like. If you don't like being seen as the same person, you want to be different. Then to literally become the same person is like a really extreme version of what you least want, in a sense, isn't it?
In fact, it is. But it is just the only way we get ideal in that way again.
You get what?
For us, ideal in that way again. Because people think from the outside that you are one identity.
For a bit.
Yeah.
Until they find out.
But if you see two of things, and then you are one identity, it's much more that you are an individual than if you are seen as
the expectations move in the right direction in a way.
I think.
I'm here with Jules Olitski at the Bernard Jacobson Gallery. Jules, you've said that an artist's vision does not strike him in the face with an aha, now I see the truth. It lies quiescent. It waits. Also, you stated that you find your work often like a landscape of dreams. I'd like to talk first of all about these two statements in relationship to your early work of the 60s and 70s and your role in the movement Pope's Painterly Abstraction, then moving on obviously to your current show here.
Well, the first part of what you read is from that thing I wrote in Partisan Review, and it probably sounds more profound than it is meant to be. An artist, in a sense, is also an artisan who does the work. And what I meant is that, in a sense, willy-nilly, the expression gets made as the art gets made. If I were beginning to paint a picture, then I could say, well, I'm now going to express my vision. But there it is, and it is as it is. I can see, let's say, an artist who I admire, Kenneth Noland. It is a vision that he expresses and re-expresses. You immediately recognize, this is a Noland. If I look back at my own work, say, starting from the 50s, you say, my God, the man has had many visions, which is his, because there's been paintings that have almost monochrome, thin surface. Other paintings followed thick, with much movement, and Sturm und Drang, you could almost say. So is that his vision? The paintings now would look rather different from what I did 5 years ago. So I suppose I have to say, well, there have been many visions, and yet to my eye, they're all related. It's all a possession of the canvas, of a blank wall. An artist takes possession, and his vision, I believe, is expressed in the design of what happens there. As some artists say, well, it means whatever you want it to mean. No, it means what I want it to mean, and there it is. There was a passage, and it was somewhat poetic. I'll try to quote it as exactly as I remember it. He said, "Behind every artist's mind, there is an architecture, there is a design. It is like the landscape of his dreams." Now, I think what Chesterton was saying, if I understand him, was that this is his vision of reality. I think an artist's paintings expresses how things work in reality, in the universe.
You've talked and written quite extensively about critics and the way they've approached your work through the years, particularly those early works and when you changed to doing your spray paintings, which you pioneered. Can we talk a little bit about the reaction to those early paintings, and then when you changed from doing, as you said, talking about the edge, which you said you knew nothing about, but you talked about it, and then to the spray paintings?
If I theorize about what is going on in the art, that comes after the making of it. As I think I said somewhere, an artist might become frightened by what he has done. He's alone with the work, and he'll seek reassurance from himself. Making the paintings, the ones that were shown at the Venice Biennale, let's say, I guess you could call it almost window shade-like, monochrome surface, but with drawing at the edge. So I look at it and I say, well, it makes, I believe, perfect sense. Yes, the edge of a shape can be seen as drawing, as a line. But when I did that, I surely wasn't thinking of that. I felt impelled to do it and to see what it would look like, and it pleased me. One does something, I do something, because it pleases me to do it. Maybe it's just as simple as that. I take pleasure in it. Schiller said, man is most holy himself when he's at play. And so there is a disinterestedness in that, in this play. One hopes, an artist hopes, that you will look at my work and have pleasure. I'm not sure that it ennobles, as people say, makes us better, more moral. Let's hope it does. But I don't see any evidence for that. And I do want to say, I'm not against political art or feminist art. Just make it so it's pleasing to see. Make it so that it's high art.
Of course, you were cited by Clement Greenberg as being the greatest living painter.
Well, of course, what Clem said meant a hell of a lot to me. I suffered a lot of burdens from it. Not everyone was pleased, you know, and my dear friends were especially displeased. But, I wouldn't sell that sentence for the world. And the rest of what Clem said in that was not just that. He said how wonderful it would be to put an Olitsky next to a, you know, a high art. And that is, I think, the challenge. Is it as good as the great masters? You know, and that's a fearful thing to contemplate almost. But that is what one must feel. Yes, yes. It is. But it's not enough to be as good or better than anyone else alive. An artist should take that for granted, that he or she is.
You're celebrating greatness and celebrating that you see a history of art that you're continuing.
Oh, yeah.
And
what
you were saying was that many artists today are working against the grain, working against that history, whereas you're following a flow of
that
history.
I feel that I'm part of the tradition. And the tradition is something that is not still. Tradition is a tradition because it continues. Now, there are traditions and traditions. And well, the first paintings that I saw as a kid at the Brooklyn Museum were watercolors by Sargent. But the painting that I felt when I saw it at the World's Fair in 1939, this Rembrandt self-portrait, oh, that knocked me on my ass.
But you talk about breaking a tradition. Of course, you were responsible for breaking a tradition at the Metropolitan Museum because you were the first living artist to have a show there. Can we talk a little bit about that? Because that was a very important moment.
By all means. I made quite a few, about close to 30, rather large sculptures. And all right, one day, Henry Gelzeller appeared, and he looked and spent about an hour or two, and as he left, at the time Henry was at the Metropolitan Museum, the curator of contemporary art, he said, "Jules, how would you like to show these at the Met?" And I said, "Yes, indeed, that would be lovely." And he said, "Well, there is one problem, that we have a rule that no living artist." And then he said, "But I'll call a board meeting and see if we can change the rule." It didn't occur to me for a minute that this could happen. But indeed it did. A certain critic was outraged at the show, said that it was the worst painter in America is now showing the worst sculpture. And how dare the Met allow this? And Olitsky must have powerful friends. As a result of that piece in the newspaper, it broke records for attendance because people came to see
bad publicity.
The very worst painter making the worst sculpture imaginable. They had to see it, you know.
I'd like to move on now to your current show. Very celebratory paintings, lots of colour, beautiful kind of threads of colour and light through the work. Perhaps we could talk about the theme of the show and also your wonderful phrase, I think, expect nothing, do your work, celebrate, which I think is a marvellous life-giving force.
Well, yes, I think that it's life-saving. How in the face of a seeming nullity, or, you know, how do you stay alive with a life force? But I believe there is such a thing. There is a creative force that we can turn away from or engage with. If I have this flow of colors, the paint flowing into other colors and flowing over the whole, and then if I took a big gob of paint and I went pow, without deciding exactly where, I'll walk around it and then pow, without, and put it there, and the relation between the two makes for love happening. It's a kind of lovemaking.
You move the paint around a lot through different methods. I mean, you kind of blow it across the...
Yes,
the canvas. Again, do you want to describe how you do that?
Yes, it occurred to me what would happen if I got a leaf blower,
which is quite a force, a
tremendous roar, and really moves the painting around. And you begin composing with that powerful instrument, and things happen. Can I use that? No, I can't use that. I'll go over it again. And something else, and something else, until, yes, there's nothing more I can do here. No.
You also described the way that you create your work, the kind of extraordinary feeling of Frankenstein when he sees the monster and it's alive.
Yeah, then I know it's right. Mm. Even if it looks completely other than what I had done previously, I know it's right. And it's a thing that we say to each other. You know, Noland or I, when we lived close and saw each other's work, does it work? Does it work? Yeah, it works.
So we can just walk around the exhibition a little bit.
What I was going to say before, and I had forgotten this, but the first time I did the painting of this...
Now, you're saying like this. We're obviously looking at the passages now.
Yes. So the last couple of years or so, I've been doing these, I think. By itself, it's rather ravishing. And then I have...
That's the Bathsheba Reverie.
My hand full of this pumice-like material. And I'm going to drop it onto this rather lovely painting, and I may destroy the whole thing.
Do you like that element of risk? The fact that something can happen
yes.
that can maybe be a mistake, but maybe yes, it could be really